Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and the 13-hour Rand Paul filibuster was the senator's attempt to get an answer about whether the president has the authority to order the killing of an American citizen on U.S. soil. Now, that's a hypothetical question. But what has actually happened is that the president has targeted an American citizen on foreign soil. Maybe you saw the long New York Times piece about the Obama administration's white paper outlining the legal justification for killing that American, Anwar al-Awlaki, an American living in Yemen and a high-level al-Qaeda operative in 2011. Joining us now is one of the authors of that piece, Times Washington correspondent Charles Savage. Charlie, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on.
Remind everybody who Anwar al-Awlaki was and what led up to his being targeted and killed in September 2011.
Absolutely. So Anwar al-Awlaki was a radical Muslim cleric. He was a U.S. citizen. He had been born in New Mexico. And he appears to be the first case since the Civil War of the United States government deciding specifically to kill an American citizen without a trial as a wartime enemy. He had preached in the United States for some years leading up to 9/11, and it occasionally attracted the attention of the FBI. He had had some contact with some of the 9/11 hijackers, incidentally, at one of his mosques. But in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, he seemed to be sort of a bridge builder, try to explain Islam to America, religion of peace type person. But then he moved abroad and eventually became much more radical, and began putting out English-language sermons on the Internet and writings, which called directly for attacks on the West and sort of fed into the notion that all of Islam was at a war. It was at war with the United States and Western countries. And for some time, he seemed to be a sort of radicalizing influence, just sort of super insider, propagandist. His materials were found on the computers of a number of terrorists who were captured or, carried out plots but didn't succeed or didn't
succeed. Example, one high-profile example, if people have forgotten, was the Fort Hood shooter who said that he was inspired by the writings online of Anwar al-Awlaki, right?
Nida al-Hassan, yes, that was in November of 2009. Not just inspired by, but it actually exchanged some emails with al-Awlaki. But al-Awlaki, as far as we know on those emails, didn't tell him to do it. Was just sort of having a philosophical discussion with him about whether it would be counter to Islam for a member of the American Armed Forces to attack other members of their armed forces.
But then al-Awlaki went even further, according to the president, on that day in September 2011 when he announced the drone killing of al-Awlaki. Listen.
Al-Awlaki was the leader of external operations for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In that role, he took the lead in planning and directing efforts to murder innocent Americans. He directed the failed attempt to blow up an airplane on Christmas Day in 2009. He directed the failed attempt to blow up U.S. cargo planes in 2010. And he repeatedly called on individuals in the United States and around the globe to kill innocent men, women, and children to advance a murderous agenda.
So, Charles Savage from the New York Times, that's all pretty much accepted, that al-Awlaki had kind of flipped from being a spiritual leader or a philosophical leader of al-Qaeda to an operational leader before he was targeted?
Well, it depends on what you mean by accepted. I mean, there's certainly been lots of information out there put out by the government in various forms, both officially and sort of court filings, assertions, and Treasury Department designations, and unofficially through sort of anonymous leaks that he had indeed evolved from being a propagandist to being an operational planner of specific attacks. On the other hand, they never indicted him. He received no trial, and usually when the government is going to kill a citizen, that is, execute a citizen, they first need to go through some sort of judicial process to prove their assertions, and that didn't happen here. And so that's why this remains and is going to remain, I think, a landmark event, an event that a lot of people are arguing about, and an event that everyone wants to know more about because it becomes a precedent for even if it's true that Aleqi was who they say he was, that future presidents can use potentially to target future American citizens. And so that's why even a year and a half after this strike, we put the resources in to try to advance the ball some and answer some of the outstanding questions about the decision-making process that led up to this, who decided what when, what issues did they struggle with, and I think there's still a lot left to be told.
So a lot of your article in the Times yesterday was about a white paper that became public through a leak last month that was evidently prepared after the killing of Al-Awlaki to legally justify it, a second draft of a memo prepared in advance of the killing. That was the white paper. And here's a clip from the Rand Paul filibuster where he references the Awlaki killing and the white paper's criteria. This is 48 seconds.
The criteria for the drone strike program overseas really is something that I think most Americans wouldn't accept for their fellow citizens. Overseas, one of the most famous American citizens they killed was Al-Awlaki. Before he was killed, he was primarily killed as someone who they said was a sympathizer. I think there's no question he was a sympathizer. He, I think, denounced his citizenship. He was a bad guy. He sympathized with our enemies. And I think he could have been tried for treason. I think if I were on the jury, from what I've read of the non-classified information, I would have voted for his guilt and for his death. But the thing is, some kind of process might be helpful. His son, though, 16 years old, was killed 2 weeks later in a separate drone strike, and he was on nobody's list that I know of.
And the 16-year-old son, from everything I've read, was killed by mistake. He wasn't purposely targeted, as Al-Awlaki himself was. But I thought it was very important to play that clip from the Rand Paul filibuster, Charles, because everybody was taking it as a single-pointed filibuster, that the U.S. should not see itself as having the constitutional authority to launch a drone strike against a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil without trial, especially if that person is a non-combatant. But he went further. He was really opposing this drone strike on a U.S. citizen who was seen as a combatant on foreign soil.
Let me make a series of short points here because to respond to everything you said since
sure.
I spoke last. So first of all, to clarify, the white paper, which leaked a week or two ago, was not a post hoc legalization of the strike, and it was not the subject of our story.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, there was a still top secret Justice Department memorandum developed in early 2010, and then a second, much longer one developed signed in sort of June-ish 2010. That one was about 63 pages, that was dense with legal analysis about Aleqi himself, as well as factual analysis about what sort of classified intelligence led them to believe that he was a senior operational planner and one who could not be captured and arrested and brought back for trial as the way to sort of remove the threat that he posed. The white paper was developed months after he was killed, when there was an internal debate in the administration about how public to be both to Congress and to the public at all, how much to disclose. And it sort of stripped out all the secret stuff about Aleqi, all the references to him, all the intelligence about him, and was just the abstract legal reasoning, and it was not classified. So that provided a little greater glimpse at their legal reasoning, but it's not quite as you described it, the thing that was what mattered before they pulled the trigger. Secondly, I think I'm not, you know, Rand Paul's filibuster, and when you get up there and you talk for 13 hours, of course,
you say a lot of things about a lot of things. Right.
I'm not sure that he objected necessarily to the strike at Aleqi, although he raised a lot of questions about it and what the process was and what sort of precedents it might create for other contexts. But he seemed to be more concerned about people who were not combatants and so forth. And so then that just raises the question of whether Aleqi was a combatant, not whether there's no circumstances under which the U.S. government can't strike at someone overseas who can't be arrested. And of course, the sort of disastrous strike, which ended up killing Aleqi's teenaged son a couple weeks later, it's hard to justify. The administration says that they didn't target him. They were trying to hit someone else who turned out not to be there, and the intelligence was bad. And I think there's a lot of unanswered questions still about what exactly the intelligence was, how it was so bad, who they thought was down there, whether they realized that was kind of an outdoor restaurant rather than some kind of encampment. And Rand Paul said some other interesting things as well. It's true that the ostensible purpose of his filibuster was to force the administration to concede that it can't use drones to blow up cafes on U.S. soil, which is sort of an extreme scenario, and I don't think it costs the administration that much to say, no, that's not what we're going to do, although it took them long enough to come out and say that.
Right.
But he ranged further into all kinds of interesting issues that Congress has done very little oversight on, at least in public eye, including the standards for strikes aimed at groups of people whose identities are not known overseas. And so it was an extremely interesting moment for catalyzing wider discussion of these issues.
Listeners, any reaction to the New York Times article, if you saw it yesterday? Were you already familiar with the Anwar al-Awlaki case and its relationship to the Rand Paul filibuster as one of the underlying issues, or anything else you want to say to Charlie Savage, correspondent for the New York Times in Washington, who was one of the reporters on this story? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or you can post your comment to our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Charlie, why not capture him, someone like Awlaki, and put him on trial instead of killing him? Does the white paper argue that in the absence of a way to capture the target, that only then killing him is okay?
It's close to that, but not. The nuance is important of how it's different. So the premise, I mean, again, we're talking about not the white paper. We're talking about the real memo.
Mm-hmm.
The white paper is just sort of derived from it later on, when they don't want to show people the real memo.
Fair enough.
And by the way, we're fighting a lawsuit to try to get the real memo into the public eye. The premise put to the Justice Department is, assume you can't capture him. Assume that merely arresting him and, you know, bringing him to trial either in Yemen or in the United States is not feasible. Then what can you do? Under those circumstances, is it lawful to have a drone, you know, drop a missile on him? And so, of course, there's a lot of play in the joints around that premise. Like, what does it mean to be feasible? Is it the same thing as impossible, or just difficult, or you know? But he's a person who's running around in hiding in rural Yemen, where the United States does not have troops on the ground. It only has air assets, both piloted and unpiloted aircraft above, and it has a permission secretly from the Yemeni government to carry out strikes from the air, but does not have permission from the Yemeni government to put commandos on the ground. And so that means, if someone's going to capture him, it has to be Yemeni forces, and they have been trying for years to do so and had failed. And so that's, I think, the surrounding context of he's probably not feasible to capture him. But one of the things that's confusing to a lot of people about this is that the Justice Department answered the question, would it be lawful to pull the trigger under these circumstances? And one of those circumstances was capture is infeasible. It didn't answer the question, is that the only circumstance in which it's lawful? And when this was sort of filtered out in the white paper, which was stripped of the, you know, references to Awlaki and his specific circumstances, some people misunderstood some of these characteristics that remained in the white paper, like infeasibility of capture, as necessary conditions or something that was, you know, legally relevant in all circumstances when the U.S. government might be considering whether or not to strike at a citizen who poses some kind of threat. And that's not the case. All these other questions about what's the minimum characteristics, what's the maximum, what can they do, what can they not do, in general, the department has not answered. And so it's who knows what they think, or if that situation would arise.
And you could go down the list of other hypothetical questions that Rand Paul could have asked Eric Holder to answer, like, instead of just, does the president have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill an American not engaged in combat on an American soil? What about, does he have the authority to use a weaponized drone to kill a non-American not engaged in combat on American soil?
And here's that leads me into one of the things that drives me the most nuts about this conversation is this whole focus on the word drone should not be part of that question, because it doesn't matter for legal purposes whether the missile is fired from a drone or whether it's fired from a F-16 or whether it's a sniper with a rifle on a hill nearby, or whether it's a guy coming up behind him with a big rock and clunking him on the head. Lethal force is what matters, not the weapons platform. And people are so confused about this. They keep talking about drones as if that makes a difference in terms of the legal standards and the constitutional standards. It's totally irrelevant.
In fact, I think we have a couple of callers on points like this. So let's take Bob in Morris County. Bob, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. That was exactly the point I was making. And I guess I have a couple of comments, especially in light of what we heard from the Karzai administration today. And I think it goes to, your guest is saying about the confusion that's out there. And the first thing I would say is I don't believe Rand Paul was being genuine in his questioning of the Obama administration. I think he asked some legitimate concerns, but whether or not a bomb is being fired from a plane with a pilot in it or, a computerized drone, what's the difference? We have a constitution. We have laws that spell out very specifically whether or not the American government can use the military on American soil, and the difference between the CIA's role and the FBI. So I don't find that to be a credible argument at all, and I don't think it was a serious question. But I have more concerns about the role of the press today, because I don't feel like they're doing their job. And I look at the Karzai administration, and they're politicizing an event. And where is, the American press in its most obnoxious form questioning him? And if we don't have access to it, why are not the major media outlets demanding access to him when we have so much blood spilled in Afghanistan, so much money spent, and so much heartache with very little results to show for it. When are we going to start demanding from that administration answers as to what they're doing with our money and what results we as Americans can begin to expect from them? I'll sign off and listen. Thanks.
Bob, thank you very much. And, of course, I think the Obama administration is now trying to get out of there and not give them too many more resources. But if you want to say anything to that, Charlie, I guess he was referring to Karzai's accusation yesterday that the U.S. is somehow colluding with the Taliban to make Afghanistan more dangerous, to prove that it's going to be unsafe without the U.S. there, which, frankly, when I saw that on the news, I really didn't understand, because, again, I think Obama is trying to do everything he can do to get Americans out of there.
I guess that's what he was referring to. I'm not sure how the press failed in what does he want the press to do, not report that or report that a sentence, by the way, Karzai is clearly crazy here? I mean, I think it speaks for itself.
Cleo in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Cleo.
Hi, Bart. It's very hard for me to hear you again. I think it's my phone. I just wanted to say one thing. Why are we treating them like this?
Who?
Because they beheaded Daniel Pearl. I'm not Jewish. He was an American, and what they did was listen, these people, you cannot deal with them. They are horrible, and I don't understand us being so kind to them. That's my comment.
Cleo, thank you. Well,
I can respond to that. I mean, so Daniel Pearl, Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped by an Al-Qaeda
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed
in Pakistan and was beheaded. Well, maybe Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Oh, well, he admitted.
KSM confessed under interrogation that was him. Yeah,
right.
But KSM probably said all kinds of things under interrogation
right.
That may or may not be tainted by coercion. So Al-Awlaki is not part of Al-Qaeda itself, or wasn't. He was said to be part of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a different group that was sort of aligned with the original Al-Qaeda, the KSM bin Laden group, but was based in Yemen. Some of the questions, of course, are, who are these people that we're at war with? Are we at war with the original Al-Qaeda? Are we at war with anyone who starts his own group and, writes Al-Qaeda on the sign in front of his house? And that's one of the sort of enduring problems that's escalating now as we get further and further away from the 9/11 and the original Al-Qaeda, which was destroyed. The other question, though, of course, that is why this is so interesting is Well, yes, if you're certain that this is a bad terrorist, then, you know, all kinds of questions of using force become easier. The hard question, though, is how do you know? So the government says this guy was, but are they right? What's their evidence? Show the proof. This, you know, the cry would be put them on trial. That's how you decide whether or not the person is the bad person who should be executed or killed.
Could they...
And then the hard question comes when, well, what if the person can't be arrested and captured, as in apparently they decided in this case that, you know, you don't have trials in absentia in this country.
And then you get to the question of what does it matter if he's an American citizen, which so much of the new debate seems to hang on. If Alaki was a Yemeni citizen, let's say, and directing some kind of Al-Qaeda, regional Al-Qaeda operations, would the legal question be different than if he was an American citizen living in Yemen and conducting the same acts of war against the United States?
Well, there are several ways in which it might be. You know, the United States Constitution says you should not be, your person can't be seized unreasonably. That's the Fourth Amendment. That's the question you look at usually when the police have killed someone, and the question is whether that was appropriate use of force. It says you can't, government can't deprive a citizen of life without due process of law. So what does due process of law mean in this context? There's a statute that says Americans may not kill other Americans overseas. Does that apply? None of that statute and those provisions of the Constitution do not apply to non-citizens abroad. And so you don't have to ask those questions if it's a Yemeni in Yemen. But you do have to ask those questions if it's an American, right, no matter where he might be.
Well, here's Jim in Queens, who I think has a proposed answer to that question in the case of Alaki. Jim, hi.
Well, I don't know if I have an answer, but basically I'm looking at page 7, section 13 of my U.S. passport, and it talks about loss of U.S. citizenship, and they give you some conditions. Number 3 is serving in the armed forces of a foreign state. Now, I know Al-Qaeda is not a country, but if they are conducting operations against the United States and you're, quote, serving, which can mean anything, then why would stop the government, unless it's a long process, to rescind that person's U.S. citizenship? And therefore, you know, those same rules that apply to U.S. citizens don't apply to... And another thing, too, another question I have, are we setting up a Pandora's box internationally with this stuff? Like, what if the Chinese one day want to go after some Chinese terrorist that's in the United States that we don't want to hand over? Are we setting this up where other countries can willy-nilly come in and attack us?
Jim, they're both great questions. We're almost out of time. Let's deal with each of those. First, on the clause on the passport, citizenship.
Right. Well, so he already flagged one issue that's tough, which is joining Al-Qaeda is not joining the forces of a nation state. But beyond that, even though it may say that in a passport, the Supreme Court has ruled that a citizen of the United States cannot be stripped of his citizenship involuntarily. You know, you can try him for treason, but you can't strip him of his citizenship. He has to specifically intend to be losing his citizenship, and there's some case involving, you know, well, did you, when you joined this foreign army, did you intend to lose your citizenship or not? Or maybe you just intended to join the foreign army without losing your citizenship. So it's all well and good for the State Department to print that on a passport, but the Constitution says they can't take it away involuntarily. As far as the other question about what, you know, what precedent are we setting, that's absolutely one of the most interesting questions about all this. I mean, the hypothetical was a Chinese terrorist, but, you know, what if it's someone who the United States does not consider a terrorist, but the government of China does consider, you know, a threat to their national security? And one of the things that seems to be developing in the legal analysis here is it's not just if the host country consents, as Yemen did, but also if the host country is unable or unwilling to suppress the threat, the U.S. thinks it can take action directly. And so you can imagine a scenario where the Chinese government says, here's this guy living in New York, he's inciting all this violence against us, you need to arrest him. And the U.S. government says, well, we have a First Amendment here, we're not going to arrest him at all, therefore the U.S. is unable or unwilling. Is that really a standard that we would be happy with if some other country applied it on our soil, right? And the question, of course, answers itself.
Could the U.S. have tried Alaki as a U.S. citizen in absentia?
As best as I can tell, the federal rules of criminal procedure do not allow trials in absentia when someone's not. You can take them out of, if they're disruptive once the trial is started, you can keep going, or if they, like, break out of jail and run away, you can keep going. But they have to be there at the start of their trial.
Well, one of the things that may come of this whole debate is creation of a drone court so that it's not the president unilaterally, because this is very much an executive power debate, much as it was during the Bush administration with the things that he said he could do without having to go to court. So do you expect this to actually come about or have a serious policy debate about it in Congress, the establishment of drone courts before anybody could actually be targeted for, you know, for ordered killings?
Well, there's been more chatter about that discussion both on among sort of national security legal policy, you know, scholars and bloggers, as well as some members of Congress have floated the idea. There's all kinds of questions and difficulties raised by the notion. It would be some sort of like a death warrant court. Mm. Again, I would resist calling it a drone court because mm-hmm. drones are irrelevant. It's lethal force, regardless of the platform by which it's delivered. You know, so much of these targeting decisions seem to be contingent upon short-term circumstances. You know, we've found this guy. He might be in this house for the next 12 hours. Who else is there? You know, and the answer of whether it's lawful to pull the trigger might shift depending on these sorts of things. So this is one of the things that the executive branch has tended to say. This is not something a court is equipped to respond to. I'm sure the executive branch would resist that. But on the other hand, they resisted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court back in the 70s, and Congress imposed it on them anyway. Mm-hmm. That was for national security-related eavesdropping on Americans' phone calls and eventually emails. So it'll be very interesting to watch that develop.
Well, Charlie Savage was one of the reporters of that long New York Times article yesterday about the Obama administration's legal justification for targeting U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki for lethal force in Yemen in 2011. And Charlie, if you're successful in your quest to get those original memos actually released to the Times, consider this an invitation to come back on and talk about
them. All right. Thanks very much.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC coming up next, Bridging the Gap Between the Natural and Technological Worlds. We'll talk to the author of a new book called All Natural, who grew up with hippie parents and what he would call an alternative all-natural orthodoxy. Now he's trying to bridge the gap. Stay with us.